back to basics is a hard task, but what we found is that meeting after meeting, where we've looked at different novels, people have wanted to come and talk and discuss the relevance of these novels to today. I would remind you that today we are going to be addressed by Les Cox on The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists, which was written by Robert Tressel. I will tell you of future meetings in this series in due course, and I will also advise you of literature that is available here today and other opportunities for you to become involved in educational and other events in the course of this meeting. The order of the meeting will be as follows. I will call upon Les to speak for 30 to 40 minutes on the novel in question, The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists. I'll ask you to give him an uninterrupted hearing. After that, I'll call for questions, discussion, and an opportunity for anybody to throw any light on this subject, including any opposition, which will be freely entertained in the course of this meeting. With that introduction, I pass you over to our speaker today. Yes, Carl.
Thank you, Carl. It's quite a good turnout, isn't it, considering who and what. And it did occur to me that had the subject matter in my talk been on an obscure, lesser-known work, something that none of you have read, I might have been able to busk my way through it and get away with it, and you'd never know anything different. However, I am aware that most people have read The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists and probably know more about it than I do, or at least as much. So if I go off the track and come to conclusions that you don't fully agree with, please don't hesitate to let me know. The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist has a peculiar history, really. It nearly never got published at all. It was published 3 years after Robert Newman's death, during the 1914-18 war, the early part of the First World War. And considering the climate of opinion then, and the fact that a bloody war had started and socialism was the last thing on the mind of the establishment and the publishers and all the rest of it, it's rather fortunate that it didn't get sort of buried away somewhere by its relatives or lost. However, we are lucky in that it was eventually published, albeit with a lot of amendments and deletions and sort of editing out of the more controversial matter. But today you can, as most of you know, get the full unabridged version. Now, the I propose to call it the RTP from now on, because it's a short, it's quicker to say that than every time. The RTP, as I say, had an interesting history. And in a book, The Socialist Novel in Britain, the section written by Jack Mitchell on this is quite interesting and says better than I could how it fits into that early, just after the turn of the century, socialist and working class literature, of which there wasn't a lot around. There were novels about the working class written by sort of upper income groups who thought they knew what was going on, but wrote in something of a condescending way and didn't really have the experience that Robert Tressel had of actually working. This is what Jack Mitchell says. 1914 is something of an annus mirabilis in the publishing history of the British proletarian and revolutionary democratic novel. At the high point of that first modern rank and filers counter-attack against monopoly capital, known as the Great Unrest, three works appeared through which that same spirit barged into the mainstream of the English novel. In Robert Tressel's The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist and in Patrick McGill's Children of the Dead End, it expresses itself directly. In John McDougall Hayes' Gillespie, more indirectly. All three helped to a varying degree to lay the foundations for a new departure in realism. The ragged trousered philanthropists and the children of the dead end must be seen as part of the worldwide breakthrough of proletarian, socialist, realist, imaginative prose, which took place almost immediately upon capitalism's transition to its imperialist and decadent stage in 1900. In the few years between the 1905 revolution in Russia and the outbreak of World War I, were written, apart from those mentioned above, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, Jack London's The Iron Heel, Martin Anderson's Nexos, Nexos Peli Aerobrero, and Maxim Gorky's Mother. Conquest of the longer imaginative prose genre is part and parcel of the general coming of age of the working class. Of course, this class could not and did not wait until entering upon its maturity to produce a complex and effective body of literature, particularly in the field of poetry and the operative genres. But that universal, insatiable, positive curiosity about every detail of living and their society, which is a sine qua non for the mastery of the strategic realist prose form, is only reached after the class has convinced itself through a long history of achievement that not only has it something to offer in human terms, but that it is coexistent, coextensive with humanity as such, humanity in its dynamic essence. Both the cumulative practice of the international proletariat and the development and dissemination of its scientific theory had established the basis for such a view of itself by 1900. In other words, until the working class had convinced itself and had encouragement and convinced itself of its ability to express itself in novel terms, in a novel, on equal terms with other novelists and writers of the time, until then it would have been unthinkable for such a work to have appeared. Now, Robert Tressel's real name, as the chairman has already mentioned, was Robert Newman. Now, he died of tuberculosis at the very young age of 40 in 1911, 3 years before his momentous novel was published, just as the First World War was breaking out. Why is it called the Ragged Trousered Philanthropists? After all, the ragged trousered people are the poor. How can you call them philanthropists? What have they got to give? Well, it's because, as Robert Tressel makes the point, they philanthropically donate all the wealth that they create to the owners and only ask for a little of it back to keep them going. I mean, you can't get more philanthropic than that, can you? And so that title is a little an indication of Robert Tressel's irony, which appears in the novel itself in many, many instances. And it's the way he does it is very well done. And for socialists and non-socialists, the points are often made in an ironic, comical way, obliquely, and for that reason they have in a sense a greater effect than just spelling out a situation. The author travelled to and worked in many other parts of the world, South Africa for instance, and was at one time a policeman, but don't hold that against him, because, you know, in those days, wherever you were, you got a job, and if there was a vacancy in the police force, to earn a few bob, it didn't necessarily mean, and did not mean in this case, that he was in any way on the side of the owners or of the owning class. He worked as a skilled house decorator for a number of years when he experienced for himself the conditions and events portrayed in the novel, as he says, at first hand, in Hastings, Sussex, which in the book becomes Monksborough. Monks, it speaks for itself, a town of monks. Notice that the setting is not a northern industrial setting where one would expect harsh conditions to be portrayed and factory, the black country, the hellish machines of capitalism in a northern industrial city. No, it's about a very nice middle-class town of Hastings on the coast. That, you know, with all those posh hotels and elegant people and nice behaviour and pretty gardens along the seafront. And behind all that, the same poverty, the same degradation, the same exploitation, the same suffering. And the fact that he worked in that area and chose that as the setting, it somehow it makes the point even stronger, I think. Frank Owen is the main character in the book, and he is the mouthpiece for the socialist ideas and arguments with his workmates, the foreman, and all the rest of it. So, as you will by now appreciate, the Ragged Trousers Philanthropist is really one of the most significant novels to have been written and published this century. The fact that it got published at all, as I said, in 1914, considering its subject matter, was a surprise and a delight to those involved. It was the first novel of its kind to reveal in explicit and easily comprehended terms the reality of the subjection, exploitation, and relative poverty of the working class at work. We do have tracts and pamphlets and material about the destitution and poverty of those in the workhouse out of work, those unemployed from those times, but not so much about what it's like to be in work, receiving the wage, and still not being able to pay the bills, still suffering, still having to endure absolute degradation. And the abject poverty of existence endured generally by the working class in these good old days is something that Tressel wants to highlight. These good old days, quotes of the Edwardian age, those were the years of stability. That is to say, when everyone knew their place and was supposed to be quite contented to stay there. What actually went on in those days of purported political and social stability and contentment is the main subject matter of this novel. It is a masterpiece of its genre, not least because it is entertaining, an easy read. It's informative, witty, sardonic, passionate, and pathetic in turn. Sometimes, in my opinion, perilously bordering on bathos. But because the sincerity shines out and floods everything that he says and every event and description of the conditions and the discussions and the arguments and the place of work, when he brings in wives and children, who of course suffer along with the employed or unemployed man, some people have criticised some of the passages on the grounds that it's a bit sentimental. Bathos is the word that one critic has used. It descends into bathos. But in my opinion, if you read it in the right spirit, the right kind of context, this is not the case. He is merely putting words into characters' mouths which would have been spoken. Children, wives, suffering. How are we going to pay, you know, ill? Sickness was around. People died of diseases that, one ought not to die of, and which today can be treated, and could be treated in those days. And most of the what the critics call a sentimentality is really a description of what happens when you're not eating enough, when you're not warm enough in the cold winter nights, and how you get ill. Well, you know, we know about that because very little's changed. We know about elderly people who are cold and ill and die. So I would reject that contention. Now, as I say, it is also, it has the merit of being without dry or insufferable propagandizing, which would otherwise perhaps have made it hard going. You know, you would read it out of a sense of duty rather than pleasure. But it avoids that propagandizing in a party political sense, and instead offers that ideological approach through conversations, which, as you read it, become more and more sort of natural. You could well imagine people holding these, having these arguments and misunderstandings. It's certainly not a political tract, and you know, the Socialist Party wouldn't suggest it as a political tract in the sense of being full of heavy theoretical stuff. But it does contain, in the course of the dialogue and the descriptions and the situations and the events, as much as any non-socialist would need to be, if they had an open mind, convinced about socialism. It's very convincing precisely because it doesn't ram every theoretical point home in a hard sort of dry theoretical way. The RTP is a sort of a year's journey through hell. And that's appropriate, I think, because it's about journeymen, or as they used to be called, tradesmen. And it's a journey of journeymen through a year of hell. But it is just one year, a one-year slice out of a never-ending hell till death's happy release, perhaps. And many of the people working in those days, when they were made unemployed, thrown on the scrap heap, no social security, no financial support except from friends, other workmates who might meet you in the street and pass you a tanner. But apart from that, when you saw your children starving, and your wife ill, and all the furniture sold, and you're sleeping on the floor, on some sacks that are ironmonger or a greengrocer has kindly given you, you can well imagine that death is would be looked forward to as a happy release. And that happened. There were lots of suicides in those days, and there still are now. But you know, it's important to bear in mind that you know, we're not talking about conditions where you're poor if you can't afford a new video. It's quite a different kind of problem. As one gets into the lives of the characters, you can feel the hellishness, experience the cold, the dirt, the fear, the sweat, the aching muscles, the smell of the slightly off toasting bloater being toasted during the dinner break, which we would now call the lunch break, mixed with the pong of paint and turps. Nothing to sit on except upturned buckets. No kind of fancy cutlery or crockery, just cracked cups and empty jam jars. These are real experiences of real people. They're our grandfathers, yours and mine. That's what they went through. And this was and is, still is, for many people, a hell created by one's fellow human beings, inhabited by what at first seems to be helpless victims. And that's how Trestle starts, illuminating the helplessness that people feel. A helplessness which makes them reject, block out any kind of mental effort to work it out, to work out what's going on, what the whys and the wherefores. In that state of helplessness, it's very difficult to, as it were, turn your attention to the cause and the solution. You feel in a kind of a state, frozen state of helplessness and totally ineffectual. Nothing you do or say could make any difference. And this is the kind of milieu that that Trestle enters into. And attempts to do something about it. Now, Trestle asks, are they really helpless and hopeless? Can it be possible that they may begin to see a way out, a glimmer of hope? Is it possible that by a supreme effort of will and intelligence, aided by those who know and are prepared to pass on that knowledge and to encourage and cajole, these curtains of ignorance and fear and placidity might be drawn aside, and that the true nature and cause of their daily grind and seemingly endless degradation might be discerned. And might not this understanding and self-esteem lead them to a commitment to what must be done to remedy the situation, and perhaps eventually change the world? This is what these ordinary people, through Robert Tressel's believable mouthpiece, Frank Owen, seek to achieve. And in so doing, show to us vividly and painfully, yes, but vividly and clearly, that people like us can rise up, can elevate ourselves to an extraordinary level. Ordinary people elevating themselves to an extraordinary level and to an unexpected sense of power over our destiny, much to the dismay of our masters. This sense of power takes a long time of coming, but it can be done with diligence and application. And once that click in the mind has taken place, once that phase transition, to use a modern technical term, has taken place, that sense of power removes, washes away, wipes away the sense of helplessness and ineffectuality that most of the people endure and suffer. So one of the main objectives, I suppose, of the Socialist Party is to convince people who are not socialists, not politically aware, not involved, that they really do have a considerable power, potentially, if they were prepared to use it. And obviously, Robert Tressel was thinking along the same lines. Now, to the book itself, we have. This is the book that I've. This is the one that I've been linked because it's the unabridged one. As I mentioned before, the early editions were heavily edited, abridged, and peculiar cuts and erasures were made. In this particular book, the cuts are included in square brackets, and for the life of me, I couldn't see why some of them were cut out at all. They didn't seem to me to be all that offensive or undermining or unclear or anything like that. So it's a bit of a... perhaps some of you know can explain why some of those bits were cut out, those who are more familiar with, who have read it recently. Now, I think I'd better read a little bit about what Robert Tressel himself says in his preface. Because again, the author is bound to put word a better version than I could. He says, in writing this book, my intention was to present, in the form of an interesting story, a faithful picture of working class life, more especially of those engaged in the building trades in a small town in South England. I wish to describe the relations existing between the workmen and their employers, the attitude and feelings of these two classes towards each other, the condition of the workers during the different seasons of the year, their circumstances when at work and when out of employment, their pleasures, their intellectual outlook, their religion and political opinions and ideals. The action of the story covers a period of only a little over 12 months, but in order that the picture might be complete, it was necessary to describe how the workers are circumstanced at all periods of their lives, from the cradle to the grave. Therefore, the characters include women and children, a young boy, the apprentice, some improvers, journeymen in the prime of life, and worn-out old men. I designed to show the conditions resulting from poverty and unemployment, to expose the futility of the measures taken to deal with them, and to indicate what I believe to be the only remedy, namely socialism. I intended to explain what socialists understand by the word poverty, to define the socialist theory of the causes of poverty, and to explain how socialists propose to abolish poverty. Now, in my opinion, he does that very well indeed, as I've already said. But you might ask, well, what relevance has this, you know, tale of put upon painters and decorators at the turn of the century, set, I believe, in in the year 1906, approximately around about that time, the actual events. What, you know, things were different then, and you know, we don't have to endure that now. Better wages, better working conditions, etc. Well, my answer to that would be something like this. Its relevance is simply that of a good book that ought to be read. It's a good description of what was. It, as you read it, pennies fall into place. The penny drops. You might have had intimations or read other books or articles, and it hasn't really, the situation and the conditions haven't really penetrated in the sense of sort of experiencing them yourself. This way you can experience those things, and it's relevant in that sense. It's also relevant in the sense that if we widen the field of observation to the world at large, there are millions of workers outside of Europe, and some within Europe, who are enduring precisely those conditions. Long hours of work, dangerous work conditions, breathing dust and toxic matter, on low wages, totally treated with total disdain by their employers, thrown on the scrap heap when they're not wanted. Children, women working long hours for small wages in rotten conditions and living a life of fear and subjugation and discrimination and exploitation. Millions of them around the world today. And so the relevance of this novel can be seen in terms of those conditions which we now, having read the book, know about in detail. It's true, it's the south coast town of Hastings, but, or Mugsborough, but it's the same attitude to the working class, the same way of treating them then as a means of accumulating wealth, no more, no less. All else is irrelevant as far as they can get away with it. Of course, we know in Europe and Britain what they got away with then they wouldn't get away with today. However, I've worked in the building trade for a number of years. Some of you may be in the building trade today. And it occurs to me that I remember sites where there were no toilets. You had to go behind the bushes. I remember sites where there were no washing up facilities. I remember being sacked on the instant for not working hard enough, producing enough surplus value for the employer. I can remember safety standards, which were practically non-existent, safety procedures. I can remember people falling, injuring themselves. I can remember people being hit on the head by scaffolding clips and brain damage for the rest of their life. I know people who had legs broken, arms broken, hands sawn off in the circular saw. I work for, it's a strange thing, the firm that all these painters and decorators, it's a strange coincidence, the firm that all these painters and decorators work for in the Ragged Trousers Philanthropy is called Rushtons, Rushtons. And the worst firm I ever worked for was called Rush and Tompkins. And so, you know, it sort of brings all the memories back. And I can assure you the constant refrain on our lips was too much of the bloody Rush and not enough of the bloody Tompkins. And it's always rush, rush, rush. It's one of the reasons why I came to leave the trade, because I fell off the roof and had an accident because of rush, 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 working on my own instead of having support and scaffolding and blackboard. It's only a little job. You can get up there and do that. Just a few skills to put in. You know, a frosty afternoon, all slippery and icy, and hands get cold and frozen, and you think you're gripping and you're not, and then your foot goes on the ice and down you go and you're lucky to be alive. Well, something. It's lucky that I survived. I don't know. Anyway, so, you know, apart from, as I say, the poverty and exploitation, long hours of work, horrible conditions, poor diet of the people in the rest of the world, even now in this country and in Europe,
You go to Italy or Spain or Portugal or any of those places to a building site, not in the middle of Milan or Rome, but out in the suburbs or in a provincial town, which I've done. See the same, no safety, no tow board on the scaffolding, rickety. People working in situations where my heart comes into my mouth and I think, Christ, look, you know, I can see what might well happen there. Long hours, filthy conditions. So that's the relevance, in my opinion, of this book. Now, Owen had a very hard task in talking with his workmates, because he had to start from scratch. The normal conversations they would be having would be dogs, football, what went on in the pub last night, and things like that. So there was a certain amount of justification, Tressel would have us understand, for the attitude of his fellow workmen. For Owen had the most unusual and unorthodox opinions on the subjects mentioned. The affairs of the world are ordered in accordance with orthodox opinions. If anyone did not think in accordance with these, he soon discovered this fact for himself. Owen saw that in the world, a small class of people were possessed of a great abundance and superfluity for things that were produced by work. He saw also that a very great number, in fact, the majority of the people, lived on the verge of want. Now, in Frank Owen's effort to bring to the attention of his fellow workers these facts, he had two sort of battles on his hand. One was to attract the attention of his fellow workers and engage them in argument. And the logic, you know, if this is the case, then how do you explain so-and-so? But he also had the bosses at his shoulder. He also had Crass, the foreman, a very crass person, who apart from being a slimy, double-faced crawler, was also constantly trying to undermine Frank Owen's approach or endeavours. And many of us have experienced that. The book deals with attitudes to religion and are disposed of in a very, very enlightened, entertaining way by asking about, for instance, the child, the Robert Owen's young son, asks about people who he hears his father say, some are useful, some are useless. And he says, what about the vicar? And although Frankie did not go to church on Sunday school, he had attended, was that the parish church? Frank Owen says, he really is one of those who live without doing any necessary work, and all of the people who do nothing, the vicar is one of the very worst. He deals with the causes of poverty. Everybody in turn, most of these talks and discussions and debates, as most of you know have read the book, take place in the lunch break or dinner break. And Fred, they've only got an hour, but not a whole hour, because they've got to get their tea, toast their bloaters, or dry bread if they can't afford a slightly off smelly stale bloater. And so there's a limited amount of time, and Owen has to crunch as much as possible in that hour, because it's a long working day. You can't, there's not a lot of time. But in that time, he manages to deal with religion, with everybody knowing that the cause of poverty is A, too many foreigners, B, the tariff barriers, and free trade would cure it. All these lazy bums living on charity, they don't want to work. Every argument that you've heard about the cause of poverty and how right and proper it is that things are ordered as they are dealt with in a very, very enlightening way. He deals with all of the prejudices and the product of brainwashing and indoctrination that we are all subject to. he deals with it in such a way that his fellow workers themselves have to question their own prejudice, because he produces argument which shows that this can't be the case. Oh, well, they say, Crass would say, the foreman. Ah, well, hang on a minute. Look, I've got a cutting from the Daily Obscurer, and this proves that you're wrong. And he's been saving this cutting for ages in order to put down Frank Owen. And eventually, the time comes when he produces this cutting, and the way Frank Owen deals with it and shows that it's a load of cobblers is brilliant. He draws graphs on the wall. In the last place to be painted in any house decorating job is the kitchen, because that's where they live, that's where they have their lunch, that's where they mix the paints. The paints get splashed, the walls get splashed with paint. That's where they have the fire to keep them warm in the winter, and the black smoke goes up the wall because the chimneys are always bloody blocked. So the last place to be decorated is the kitchen. So on the blank wall that hasn't yet been prepared and painted, he draws graphs of percentages of population here, and there's a famous oblong scene where he draws this oblong and turns it into the proportions of the population, owning class, working class, those who work, and proves that way. And then there's the great money trick. I haven't got time, because the chairman tells me that I must close soon. I haven't got time to regale you with the great money trick passage, but it's a joy to read, where he shows them how the exploitation takes place, and so on. They are not idiots, these people. They are intelligent as far as their working conditions permit. They haven't had much of an education, but two things are going on here. Robert Tressel, Robert Noonan, the author, is telling us, don't put these people down, give them a chance to think for themselves. They can work their way through these problems and contradictions. And also, in the dialogue, Frank Owen is saying to the reader, this is the way I have managed to approach the problem of introducing people. If you may find some of my arguments and illustrations and logic chopping or whatever appropriate or useful. So it has that extra advantage. Now, one could describe the book as a magnificent antidote to the futile, fatuous cynicism and undeserved denigration of humanity's unquenchable curiosity and concern. Every time anybody puts their head above the parapet and shows a curiosity, concern, and understanding, voila, you're denigrated, you're put down, you're made fun of. The tabloids will make a joke of it. Teachers, likewise, sometimes, and particularly politicians, don't be put off. There is an unquenchable curiosity and concern. There is a determination among people to understand and do something about it. And even people who are not in the Socialist Party or have never heard of the Socialist Party, ask them. And once you've got over the pleasantries and the jokes and the talk about football and what was on telly last night, you'll find there's a deep concern there. But what is lacking is the understanding, and that is where we come in. We can help to exalt the ordinary man and woman's eagerness to understand what is happening to them and why. This book is an exemplary essay in how we might use that understanding as a means to grasp at a better future, at an enlightened level of expectation. And this is another aspect. If you raise the level of expectation, plus as a bonus, you add the possibility of reaching that, then you've got people thinking along positive lines. I would say, in conclusion, that this book is a small but very significant triumph of hope over adversity.